This episode is brought to you by Odd Mo's Pizza in Canby. Handmade awesome pizza plus craft beer, cider, and wine delivered. Call them today at 503-266-8444.
Welcome to the Canby Now podcast.
Your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans. And its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
And if it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Hey, friends, and welcome to Now Hear This Canby. I am your host, James Walton. Let's read the news. The Canby Farmers Market organizer, Alexis Purcell, knew that Sunday's supersized July 4th themed market would be big, but maybe not three times our previous attendance record big. Oh, it was amazing, she said with a laugh on Monday. What a day. A lot of people. We're thinking 3,000 plus. Our previous record was probably around 1,000. The event added half of North 3rd Avenue between Grant and Holly to its usual footprint. The remainder of 3rd Street, along with two blocks of North Grant, was dedicated to a car show organized by the Canby Area Chamber of Commerce. The Book Nook's sidewalk sale and Ebner's Custom Meats barbecue pit, forming an H. The result was a lively, bustling community event centered on Waite Park, the likes of which Canby has not seen since Light Up the Night celebration in December 2019. That's 3 months before the start of the coronavirus pandemic. Canby is back, the Canby Current declared in its coverage of the event on Sunday, and most seem to agree. Oh, so thankful for today, said Hannah Elise. It's the happiest I have felt in so long. Canby native Kathy Burdett concurred. So wonderful to be out and about, seeing faces and smiles, she said. I love the farmer's market, love the car show, love the live music. I got teary-eyed walking about town on this beautiful day. That live music came courtesy of Brian Haynes and his team at Canby Music, who donated their time, talent, and equipment in providing 4 hours of patriotic standbys, classic rock, country hits, feel-good summer tunes, and Haynes' trademark Star-Spangled Banner on the electric guitar. The 4th was a great day, Haynes said afterwards. We were glad to be part of it. In contrast to the positivity of the Independence Day celebration in downtown Canby, Sunday night was a period many emergency officials had been dreading. After spending much of the previous week urging citizens to forego fireworks due to record-breaking temperatures and other extreme conditions that had transformed the region into a tinderbox. A patchwork ban on fireworks, even those normally legal in Oregon, had been enacted in parts of the state over the course of the week. They were prohibited in unincorporated Clackamas County on Thursday, but still allowed, though strongly discouraged, in many cities within city limits. Canby, like most cities in Clackamas County, did not enact a ban, but officials urged extreme caution, and Mayor Brian Hodson on Sunday morning asked citizens to refrain from fireworks. Please follow the warnings, he wrote on Twitter. I'm asking you to refrain from fireworks this year. If you choose to, use the legal ones. Have water at the ready. Do them on your own driveway or in the street. And all caps here, ensure you are not near dry brush. Despite the well-earned anxiety felt by fire safety officials, the fears in many places appeared to have been mercifully overblown. In much of the unincorporated area surrounding Canby, the 4th of July was the quietest in years. And while a number of residents offered anecdotal reports of both legal and illegal pyrotechnics being used in neighborhoods throughout Canby, Fire Chief Jim Davis on Monday confirmed that there had been no fires or other firework-related issues in their jurisdiction. Thank you to all the people of Canby for being safe, Davis said. Other areas, however, were not so lucky. Clackamas Fire responded to a small brush fire just before midnight and a large commercial fire on Sunday morning on Southeast Fuller Road in Milwaukee, though it was not immediately clear if either blaze had been sparked by fireworks. But at least one fire that was reported in Hubbard in Marion County was caused by fireworks. According to one resident account, Kenya Raylene said an errant firework set a tree ablaze in her neighborhood on Dorsey Drive and 5th Street. "Unfortunately, my kids saw it first," she told the Courant. "They were scared. The whole neighborhood was on the streets. A lot of commotion." For photos and videos, you can visit canbyfirst.com and the Canby Current's Facebook page. Sadly, Oregon's historic heat wave earlier this week was more than record-breaking. It was also deadly, with a statewide death toll of 116 as of Wednesday, July 7th, and still climbing. The lion's shares of the casualties investigators have linked to the three-day heat wave have been reported in Multnomah, Oregon's largest and most densely populated county. But at least 12 heat-related deaths, slightly more than 10% of the state's total, occurred in Clackamas County, according to updated numbers from the county's medical examiner on Wednesday. Like the victims of the heat wave in general, those whose deaths were linked to excessive heat in Clackamas County were generally older, ranging in age from 55 to two victims who were 79. The county's death toll included 8 men and 4 women, according to the Clackamas County Medical Examiner's Office. 9 of the people who died were in their homes, which either had no air conditioning or air conditioners that were not functioning, the county said. One individual was living in their vehicle, which had no air conditioning. Authorities have not yet shared the names or communities of residents for those who perished, citing the need to contact next of kin. Due to toxicology and other reports and an understanding of the individual's medical and social history, investigations will not be final for 12 or more weeks. In other areas, many of those who succumbed to the heat were found alone in their homes without air conditioners or fans. Others were elderly and more vulnerable. Still others were at work, like an immigrant farm worker who was found in a field unresponsive at the end of his shift at Ernst Nursery and Farms in St. Paul this weekend. No single type of weather event kills more Americans than extreme heat, which is more deadly than hurricanes and floods combined. Heat has twice the death toll of tornadoes and 4 times the death toll of extreme cold, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. A driver died in a single vehicle crash on Ellen Road, northeast, west of Aurora, Sunday night. Police say the crash occurred at approximately 9:30 p.m. on Independence Day near La Luz del Mundo Church in northern Marion County. A Canby Police Department sergeant was reportedly heading westbound on Ellen Road when he spotted a 2007 Porsche 911 headed in the opposite direction at a high rate of speed. The sergeant lost sight of the car as he was turning around to investigate. By the time he caught up with them, he was on the scene of a fiery crash, and witnesses had already stopped to attempt to help the occupants of the Porsche. The Porsche had caught fire, which Canby police extinguished. The driver, later identified as 35-year-old Guy Reed of Tualatin, was pronounced dead at the scene despite life-saving efforts from medical personnel. Reed's passenger, Jenna Mansfield, 28, also from Tualatin, was transported to a Portland area hospital for treatment of injuries that police describe as non-life-threatening. Police did not say what other factors may have contributed to the crash, and the investigation is still ongoing. The Marion County Sheriff's Office thanked the Aurora Fire District, Canby Fire District, Canby Police Department, Marion County Medical Examiner's Office, Marion County District Attorney's Office, Marion County Public Works, and Oregon State Police for their assistance with this incident. A Salem man was arrested Monday morning after stealing a car and crashing near Silverton before getting away in another vehicle, only to collide with a utility pole 10 minutes down the road. So if at first you don't succeed, try again. According to the Marion County Sheriff's Office, Bruce Lee Wilson, 46 years old, was the driver in a single vehicle crash involving a 1999 Honda Accord in the 2600 block of the Cascade Highway just before 8 a.m. Deputies were on the way to the scene when new reports came in that the suspect had stolen a 2001 Ford F-250 of a Good Samaritan who had stopped to check on them. Police located the stolen pickup on Cascade Highway near Tree Haven Road Northeast, where the suspect nearly struck an oncoming patrol car and forced them off the road. Deputies lost sight of the vehicle, but were notified by the state and police department approximately 10 minutes later that Wilson had crashed again, this time near Scio High School in Linn County. During the crash, the Ford knocked down power lines and caught on fire. State and police were able to detain Wilson until deputies arrived. After further investigation, deputies learned that the 1999 Honda from the first crash had been stolen earlier in the morning in Salem and had not yet been reported. Wilson was taken to a local hospital to be treated for minor injuries before being lodged at the Marion County Jail. He faces two counts of unauthorized use of a motor vehicle, attempting to elude a police officer, reckless driving, and attempted assault in the second degree. Governor Kate Brown has announced she will appoint Cody Weston to the Clackamas County Circuit Court to fill the vacancy created by long-serving Judge Douglas Van Dyke's retirement back in March. Cody Weston brings an incredible depth of experience in both public service and private practice, and I am pleased to appoint him to join the Clackamas County bench, Brown said in a press release. Weston is currently a partner leading the corporate litigation division for the firm Perkins Coie. His focus is on business litigation in federal and state courts, as well as in alternative dispute venues, according to the firm's website. A Dallas, Oregon native, Weston earned his bachelor's degree from Harvard College in 1991 before joining the U.S. Marine Corps as an infantry officer and platoon commander. While in the Marines, Weston obtained his law degree from the University of Oregon and began his service as a Judge Advocate General, that's a JAG, prosecutor handling hundreds of federal court martials, and then as a staff judge advocate advising active Marines on a wide variety of civil legal issues, including family law, consumer law, wills, and trusts. He authored and co-authored a number of publications about military justice and other military legal issues. After an honorable discharge from the Marines in 2004, Weston returned to Oregon with his family and settled in Clackamas County, where he joined Perkins Coie. In addition to his expertise in commercial civil litigation, Weston has been recognized for his pro bono work on various cases, including that of Ilkayam Batiyev, an extrajudicial detainee at Guantanamo Bay who was released to Kazakhstan in 2006. Weston's other experience includes consumer lending law, intellectual property, business tort, contract, construction, real estate, and employment law. Weston's appointment is effective immediately. And that'll do it for this episode's edition of The News. Thank you so much for listening. I'm James Walton. Have a great day.
Hey, James, what's going on with the internet? The Wi-Fi is all spotty.
Well, is it your internet or the Wi-Fi?
What are you talking about? Aren't they the same thing?
Well, kind of, but no. You see, your home or office accesses the internet through underground fiber cables from DirectLink. It's actually your Wi-Fi router that converts that internet connection into an over-the-air signal for all your wireless devices.
Okay, you lost me at kind of?
Why don't we even try? Look, you have seen like a box-looking device around the studio here. It's probably hidden under, it's under a thick layer of dust.
No, I don't. Wait, is it that blinky flashy thing behind the stack of old pizza boxes?
Yeah, yes, it's the blinky flashy thing. That's the Wi-Fi equipment that connects your iPad, your PlayStation, and the laptop to the internet.
I bought that off Craigslist like 8 years ago.
Frankie, I think we just found your problem. Your Wi-Fi equipment is ancient. Electronics, they get old fast. And even when new software updates or faster broadband comes out, your old router just can't keep up. It's like expecting a Model T to outpace those new F-150 Lightnings.
Great. So now I have to make Tyler go buy, I have to go buy a whole new Wi-Fi setup? How does he, I even know what to get?
Look, I'm gonna make it simple. Just call DirectLink, man. Their professional grade Wi-Fi equipment is super affordable, and they'll manage the updates and the network security for you. They'll even help you install your new router in the perfect spot to get the strongest possible signal. You can visit directlink.coop/Wi-Fi to get started.
Well, that sounds great. I'm going to make Tyler call DirectLink today. All right, joining us once again on the Canby Conversation today are a couple of our old friends, Jason Fossera. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Tyler. How's it going?
I'm great, man. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you.
And John Runyon. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, man. How are you doing? How are you holding up?
Great. Staying cool.
Awesome. Well, why don't you guys start by just reminding us who you're with and what we're going to be talking about today, and then we'll get into it.
Sure. I'll go ahead and start, John. So I'm Jason Fossera. I'm with the Clackamas Soil and Water Conservation District. We're a local government in the Clackamas County area. It covers the basically within the county boundaries. And we help people focus on natural resource management and trying to be stewards of the land. We work with folks from agriculture all the way up through, you know, rural residential properties, urban properties, to help them just be more aware of the impacts of how they manage their property or their land, and how we can help them find ways to protect clean water and but also kind of meet their goals as well. So we're a voluntary organization that works with people. And we've been working over the last couple of years on this project, this Mullalla River project, which we talked about last, I believe, May or June with you guys.
Yep.
And we were in the middle of. And we're kind of coming to the end of this now. And you know, what this project is it's an effort to assess drinking water source quality. So not drinking water coming out of your taps, but drinking water coming off of the watershed and into the water treatment facilities to assess the quality of that and what potential issues could change the quality of that over time. So that was really the assessment that we've conducted over the last 2 years. And we're here to kind of talk about that and discuss, you know, some of the outcomes of that, some of the findings. It was funded by NRCS, Natural Resources Conservation Service, with a grant. And that grant's coming to an end now, and we've got this plan, and that's kind of what we're here to talk about.
Awesome, awesome. Yeah, very important work with the Soil and Water Conservation District, and I feel like every week, if not every month at least, we're continually reminded of how important it is to protect our resources and do better about conserving those as best we can. Before we talk more about the project, John, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your
sure.
bio?
My name is John Runyon. I'm principal with a small consulting firm based out of Portland, Cascade Environmental Group. And so I was hired by the SWCD to be the contractor that moved this process forward. My background's in watershed assessment work, water quality studies. I've done quite a bit of work in the Mullalla watershed, which has been the focus of this study.
Well, I do want to hear about the project, the findings, and the plan. I'm very interested in that. But first, I think I want to hear from you guys just about the process. I'm remembering this was announced and sort of got underway before the pandemic, but very early on, COVID hit. I think you guys had some public meetings that were among some of the first things that started getting, well, maybe we'll try next month. Maybe, okay, we're just canceling this altogether or whatever. We're doing it virtually. So I'd love to hear just, but before COVID, I mean, water quality in Canby was like one of the top issues. I mean, people talked about it a lot. It was a big thing talking about restaurants and things like that. And then of course, COVID changed so much of our daily life, especially restaurants and dining out and things like that. And just kind of got put back on the back burner, I feel, for the public. I'm sure that was a challenge for you guys to have to deal with, because you're still tasked with doing this important project that's gonna continue to be very important long after this virus has finally been taken care of. So how did you walk through that process and still, you know, do your work that you needed to do, and just how did that all affect you guys?
Sure. Yeah, it was certainly a challenge. You know, I think we came to you right after we canceled those first public meetings that we were wanting to have. And that public input piece is important for a plan like this. You know, we hear from the utilities and all those other folks and the government agencies about how it impacts them. But, you know, you don't always hear from the end user about what their concerns are and what their, you know, how we might be able to address those as well. So we really didn't get to do the in-person meetings, which I think we would have got a better turnout for than the online meetings potentially, especially since it was early in COVID and like these technologies were still kind of becoming ubiquitous. So that was certainly a challenge for us. But, you know, I think we certainly navigated that with the technical team. I still think there's room for us to get out there in the public and talk about this thing now that the plan's complete and still consider those impacts. But we did get really good feedback from the online meetings we did get. So we did get about 30 folks that came in and attended those and gave us some feedback. And, you know, we navigated the best we could. It wasn't the only challenge we faced either. John, maybe you can expand upon, you know, even the fires and how they really kind of challenged us.
Yeah. That, I mean, the fires and even, you know, maybe COVID as well, how it changed all of our behaviors and whatnot. But I feel like you guys are studying our water table, even as these like cataclysmic events are changing the water table.
Yeah, that's really true. We had to kind of go with the roll of the punches, and the fire was a huge issue, obviously. And we had to take time to kind of step back, assess what the impacts were potentially now to drinking water quality, and look at what the potential impacts could be years down the road, because it's going to take, you know, quite a while for the watershed to heal from those massive wildfires. So we incorporated that into it. That extended the timeline. Obviously, our public outreach process extended the timeline. So we had our challenges, no doubt, but that's the reality when you're dealing with the environment, things change.
I mean, honestly, like I regret the challenges that it posed for you guys, but I mean, what if you had finished it like right before COVID and then it was not relevant anymore, or the wildfires? Like it was kind of good, I guess, that this was an open process at the time and you could adjust on the fly, as opposed to just, okay, I guess we'll just toss this in the wastebasket because it's not relevant anymore. So,
yeah, especially within the fires, you know, we had considered that was always part of the plan, but it came front and center after the fires hit. It's like, okay, it's not a future issue anymore. It's now. So yeah, we had to adjust for sure. And I think we do have a better plan maybe as a result of it. We certainly didn't obviously want those outcomes, but we know maybe more what they would actually pose for challenges. And we'll be monitoring that actively as part of the plan. So yep, things change, and the impacts of the pandemic, hopefully like when that ramps down, then, you know, people will have a focus again on, you know, this issue, because it's important. It's going to be one that's important for the next, you know, 30, 40 years as population grows and as the conditions and the environment change, you know, with climate change and other impacts, you know, population growth and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I would love to dig into the report a little bit. I know you guys could probably talk about this forever. I don't know how exactly you want to walk us through it or give us some of the bullet points, but obviously I just personally, as a person who lives in this area, you know, I'm like I said before, like it was, I always kind of heard people talking, you know, kind of griping about the quality of drinking water in the context of restaurants and things like that, you know, but like now it's like, oh my gosh, I'm very concerned about wildfires and drought and our kind of status as the agricultural engine of our state and even our larger region, and just how some of these factors are affecting us and what we can do. So do you guys have sort of some bullet points that you can share with us, or some high level stuff that you feel is really relevant and digestible to us lay people?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I can just maybe just reframe again what the plan is really quickly. John can talk a little bit about the findings, and then maybe we can just delve into what the plan is and the implementation, and, you know, just kind of give some high level overview. So the 2-year assessment, you know, we talked about that before. We've gone through a lot of literature. John did a lot of work to develop kind of this wide ranging assessment that not only talked about, you know, agriculture, which is kind of our bailiwick, but also across all land uses and all impacts. And so we've gathered all this information, talked about it with the technical advisory committee, and got input from folks, and came up with this 10-year plan that we've developed to address those impacts now and in the future. So John, I don't know, do you want to talk a little bit about what the findings were from the assessment, and then we can jump into the plan itself?
Sure. It's important to emphasize that this is a 10-year plan, so we're looking out into the future. So we assess water quality both currently and try to project what it would be into the future, given, you know, the various threats that are out there. So for example, climate change, we just experienced some very high temperatures here, and the prediction is we'll have more of those in the future, and that drives water quality because basically heats up the water and increases the amount of water that's drawn from the river. So you have less flow, and that can lead to things like algae blooms and other factors that can create water quality issues.
Yeah.
Important to emphasize that the water quality now is really high. And so all the community water systems are receiving, you know, good quality water, but our job is to look out into the future and deal with threats like climate change, population growth, and wildfire, which obviously that was one threat that actually happened right in the middle of our study. And looking at that, for example, one of the key parameters that we see as a priority is turbidity. And essentially turbidity is the color of the water. You know, you think in the winter, sometimes you have this chocolate dark water that comes down the river. Well, that's high turbidity. Yeah. And turbidity can create problems at the intake in terms of treating water and at very high levels because it carries parasites and other organisms and lots of organic matter. It can be very difficult to treat, and it can reach a point where at very high turbidity levels they can't treat it. So that's an issue that we're looking out. Potentially the fires could contribute high turbidity when storms, you get high intensity rainfall events in the upper watershed. With the aftermath of the fire and some of the exposed soils, that could create landslides and erosion, which could increase turbidity levels. So that was one item that we flagged as, or one parameter that we flagged as a kind of a key one to keep an eye on and to try to monitor over time. One of the things that we confronted with this study was there's not a lot of very detailed water quality information in the watershed. There have been various studies that have been done here or there, but not a big systematic effort to understand drinking water quality. So one of the things that we propose to do, for example, with turbidity, is collect samples in the watershed of water during a storm event so we can see where higher turbidity levels, higher sediment delivery is coming from in the watershed, and then use that to target actions that could control sediment that can minimize turbidity levels. So that was one high priority item that we identified. The other one, which won't be a surprise, I think, to many of your listeners, and you mentioned it a little bit, is the taste and odor issues that Cambi has experienced in the summer in the past, where the water coming out of the tap is sort of musty, has a musty odor. And that is actually the result of algae. Blue-green algae in the river produces substances that create the taste and odor issues. And it's very, very difficult to treat that. The city of Cambi did a study to look at what it would take to pull out those constituents. And it was literally millions of dollars in upgrades to the plant, to the water treatment plant to try to address that. So we're trying to look at how are there ways that we can minimize that issue by looking at what blue-green algae are producing and what are the factors that drive that. We think water temperature is one. We think things like irrigation withdrawals, reducing the level of the water is another one. So we're really trying to focus in on those, but it's something that's going to require a little bit more study to fully understand. But that's a major issue because that is affecting the treatment and the quality of the water, in this case, coming out of the tap.
Yeah, I got a follow-up question about that, John. Do we experience that in our water table in the Cambi area more so than other areas, or do we just complain about it more? I mean, the what you describe as far as it being a natural thing and the algae makes sense, but it doesn't seem to be, you know, something that should affect our area more than any. I mean, we get our water from a moving source, you know, not a stagnant source. So I'm sort of confused by why it seems to be worse in our area. Like I said, maybe we're just more vocal about it, some of us.
No, it's a real issue, and the city of Malala does not experience it. Something's happening in the river between Malala and Cambi that's contributing these substances. And that's kind of the mystery that we're trying to untangle. We've got some pretty good ideas about what it's from, but we need to really close in on the exact mechanisms. Other cities have experienced this. I used to live in the city of Corvallis, and they pull water from the Willamette. And for a period of time, they were experiencing those issues. They no longer are. They've improved their treatment system so that they are not. But these are, I would not say it's common in flowing waters. Usually you see these algae blooms in stagnant waters.
Right.
But we anticipate with climate change and with warming and with lower flows, for example, during the summer, it could really exacerbate this issue. So it's absolutely essential that we try to figure it out.
Okay. And one other question, and maybe this will lead us into the plan a little bit, but obviously another thing that is in terms of possible contributors to sediment in the river and issues with water quality are two things that we're seeing, you know, that we have historically seen a lot in the Cambie area, obviously farming and agriculture, and that's the our whole region, as we've mentioned. And then in Cambie particularly, we're seeing a lot of more larger industrial type developments. That's a big thing in our area that's happening now. And my understanding is obviously that can have an impact on the stormwater with all the more impermeable surfaces that go in with the parking lots and obviously the buildings. Can you guys talk a little bit about that, or does that sort of lead into the plan and abatement as far as looking forward over the next 10 years about how our water table will continue to change?
Well, that's a really good point about stormwater. It's an interesting watershed because most of the land uses there are agricultural, rural residential, and forestry. And forestry is the dominant land use there. It's about 70% of the watershed is devoted to, you know, forestry land uses. There's a very, very small component, about 3% of the watershed, that's urban. For the most part, the city of Malala actually isn't in the watershed. It's right on the edge. The city of Cambie is in the watershed, but most of the impacts from stormwater are downstream of the intake. So stormwater is not, while it is an issue, it's not a major issue for drinking water quality. What is a potential issue, and one that we flagged as a high priority one to address, are contaminant spills. And those can be spills from industrial facilities. Those can be spills from the transportation network. So you have, you know, an oil tanker that spills, you know, next to the Malala River, and that material gets into the river. And there's a certain amount of travel time for it to then come to the intake. And what we've highlighted in the plan is there's really a need to be on top of those issues, to coordinate closely with the Oregon Department of Transportation, to get to understand what some of the potential hazards are at the various industrial land uses around in the watershed, and really work proactively to try to prevent spills, and then if there is a spill, to respond to it quickly.
Wow, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, Jason, we haven't heard from you for a while. Do you have more that you could share about the plan and looking forward? Where do we go from here?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So the issues that John's pointed out are, they're a wide range, and not all of them, you know, I think it's clear that even though the money for this study came from a source that typically is looking to help address ag issues, we looked very, very widely upon that and got outside of the ag area and looked at like these spill response areas and these other things that really aren't ag focused. So I think, you know, one of the takeaways here is that the ultimate success of any plan and the plan that we've developed is going to be determined by the buy-in from the community at large. You know, it's not just going to be the farm community, which we are very used to working with the farm community and rural residential properties, rural properties, on how to manage their land, but there's an urban component, a small one, you know, but this transportation network is certainly part of that. We've got, you know, city and county management of lands that they've got and their processes as well. Community groups that can help, like the Watershed Council, and then, you know, state and local governments like the district. All these folks are going to need to come together to address some of these issues, like this spill response. That's really not something the district's going to be able to help with, but we can certainly help convene people and get them coordinating and talking about that. And I think that's what's great about this plan, is it identifies those areas that are important for the community to rally around and develop plans around and implementation around. So this plan is high level in that for those, you know, those areas outside this SWCD's traditional, you know, land management assistance that we provide, is high level in that it identifies those as things that need to be addressed. So further work's going to need to be done by the community to really address those things that are outside that traditional ag role for us. But, you know, the plan, it's a 10-year plan, and we're planning at the district to convene this technical advisory committee to talk about the plan quarterly and to discuss progress. So we'll be, you know, talking with the city and the county about, you know, spill response, or talking with them about how to monitor the watershed to get better information so that we know what's happening in the watershed. And, you know, we're not surprised when, you know, a big rush of sediments coming down. We have systems in place to let us know that that's happening and where it's coming from. So just trying to take a proactive approach. So the plan identifies some very specific actions that need to happen, but it's going to take a lot of buy-in from all the stakeholders in the community to really make any change. So, we're hoping this doesn't become a plan that's stagnant. We're certainly going to work on the ag piece of it because that's our bailiwick, but, trying to also keep the other agencies and folks engaged to see these other areas of the plan that they get implemented as well. So we won't be leading on all fronts, and we're going to lean on those other partners to really help try to make the recommendations and the findings in here, get resolved or maintain the high quality of water that's there now.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So the draft plan, we've got a copy of that for folks to review if they want to do that. That's on our website, MalalaRiverDrinkingWater.com. And it's under our assessment section, and you'll see a tab for draft assessment. And that's where you can see all the data and all the findings that John and his team has put together through the effort of the TAC. And it identifies those main areas. And the plan also identifies those areas and the time frame under which we're going to address them. One of the first things we're going to look at is that turbidity piece. It's the one that's the most pressing for the water treatment areas. And with the fires and then just conditions in general, the area that we could probably make the most difference as the district to bring in resources from NRCS or some other entities to address them. So we're going to focus on some early monitoring to say, okay, where is it most impactful in the watershed to start working? Where is the most turbidity coming from? And if we can identify that, then we can go in and really effectively apply our resources to make meaningful changes in the watershed. So that's really kind of our first step, is to just do a little bit of monitoring and really try to hone in on where we need to work first, with the hope that in the next year or two, we'll actually be getting projects on the ground with farmers, that we'll be working with, or maybe some other pieces of the property or of the plan with, some of the city and county issues that they're addressing, like maybe spill response.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, this has been great. You guys have been so informative. Thank you so much. Here in our last few minutes, are there any final takeaways or things that you want to share with the public before we have to move on?
Yeah, there's one or two little things. I want to stress that this is a non-regulatory effort that we're doing. So this plan is not a mandatory plan that the watershed has to implement. We're going to rely on voluntary efforts and cooperation with all these entities to make this thing happen. But there's nothing regulatory in it. The water treatment systems are regulated already in a separate process by DEQ and EPA. So they've got all those processes in place. So we're going to continue on this non-regulatory front to try to, make changes without being regulated. And I think that really benefits everybody in the watershed. If we aren't regulated, nobody wants to be regulated. So the more we can do to address these issues and have them not become worse, the less likely we'll have to be regulated. The other thing is, some of the things that people are concerned about, there's a lot of emerging contaminants and things like that are coming down as far as technology, understanding that things like, caffeine or pharmaceuticals in the water are concerns that people have, but this plan doesn't address those. We acknowledge that those are emerging concerns, but this plan isn't, because they're not regulated at this point, it's very hard for us to get any information or any data on how those are impacting people. So those are future studies that could happen and that we've touched upon in the plan could be expanded upon in the future as more information or monitoring happens to know, how those are impacting this specific watershed. Those are the kind of the two main points that I wanted to bring up. John, do you have anything else that you wanted to just quickly touch on that we haven't talked about?
No, I think that's it. I agree with you. The plan is adaptive. So as new information is available, the plan can change to deal with that. And that's a really important consideration. There's going to be ongoing data collection so that we can track the status of the watershed over time. And if things change, the plan can adapt.
Awesome. Well, I just want to say thank you both so much for doing this work. I do think that it'll be a really useful to our area and region for the next 10 years, and especially for doing the work amid all the challenges and rolling with the punches, as you've shared. I do think that our community across a lot of different stakeholder groups is going to have a lot of buy-in for this process. So if you would, Jason, just remind us again where folks can check out that draft plan. And are there any other ways that folks can get involved? Are there any upcoming engagements or any other things to be aware of in this sort of later stages of the process?
Sure. So folks can find the information at the Molalla River drinkingwater.com website, where we have basically everything that we've talked about today, along with a couple of presentations where we get more in depth about some of the issues. So you can watch those presentations. And there's a contact us portion of that website where you can send more questions if you have them, or if you do want to get involved. Certainly, you know, as we start to do some monitoring in the watershed, there will be some room probably for some folks to help with that. So we certainly would welcome anybody who's interested in doing that to let us know. And, you know, again, we really appreciate you letting us kind of come and talk about this plan on your podcast, because we really do want the community to buy in, and hopefully your listeners will follow up and send us any questions that they have.
Awesome. Well, again, thank you guys both so much for coming on today, and have a great rest of your day.
Awesome. Thanks, Tyler.
Thanks, Tyler.
Joining us now is Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes, a firm serving all across the Portland metro area with three realtors based right here in Canby. Donna, can you tell us how Ellison Team Homes started?
I started in real estate. I grew up with my dad. He was a realtor. Mm-hmm. So I'm a second generation broker, and I grew up with him on weekends. And I learned a lot eventually working with him for several years and then going out on my own. Our family moved to Canby a couple of years ago, but we really didn't know how it was going to go. And within the first probably 3 months of being here, we literally fell head over heels in love with this place. We love the community, the spirit here. The first Christmas at Waite Park, I was literally crying because everybody was walking around saying Merry Christmas and people were drinking hot chocolate, and we got in a carriage ride with the horse, and it was just too much. You just realize it's special here. Real estate's always been my passion. It is my professional love. I enjoy the people, the relationships. So much comes out of kind of the intensity that you spend with people. You're really up in their business for a period of time. And sometimes it's a couple months. Sometimes it's a couple years, sometimes it's a lifetime.
Yeah.
I feel very blessed at this point to have people that have been with me for almost my entire career. Mm-hmm. Clients that have bought and sold maybe 2, 3, 4, or 5 homes. I have one client that's bought and sold 8 homes with me.
Yeah.
3 generations. It's a beautiful business. It makes for a very full life.
Mm-hmm. How can people find you?
How can they not, really? we have a website, www.ellisonteamhomes.com.
Well, thank you, Donna.
Thank you for having me.
All right, joining us now is Ashley Pfeiffer. She's the president of Karis Preschool. Hi, Ashley.
Hi, Tyler.
How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Good, awesome. Tell us a little bit about yourself. How long have you been with Karis Preschool, and what is Karis Preschool?
Well, I've been with Karis just 3 months before COVID hit. And then last year's craziness, I stuck through with the board, but Karis Preschool wasn't open yet. So we're just reopening, and it's my first year as president and my first full year on the board. But Karis Preschool has been around for 38 years, and it's one of the better known preschools in the area. And it's been in the elementary school for this whole time up until 2 years ago. And then they moved to the BCT building up off of Spangler, and we have a wonderful playroom and an indoor play area with a separate lunchroom. It's a really big place, so the kiddos have more space, and then the elementary got more space with us moving too. So Karis Preschool is known for being in Karis Preschool and or in elementary school, and then those kiddos all going through sixth grade at the elementary school together. So it's a pretty cool benefit for the families to be together for 7, 8 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Karis Preschool, as you mentioned, has a long history serving families out in this sort of rural community east of Canby, a lot of farms and properties like that. It's a sort of a co-op model, is it?
It is. We are a co-op, so we do rely on our parents helping out in the classrooms. We do have traditional spots, so the parents that are working or have too many other responsibilities, like maybe homeschooling or younger kiddos, they have the option to just send their kiddos to a morning or an afternoon class without helping. But the co-op parents are asked to help in the classroom 2 days a month. We also have other jobs for them, like helping us keep the yard mowed or the weeds pulled, and just we really rely on our families to help us keep it going. And our board is a huge part of it. Whether it's bookkeeping, registering, treasurer, our teachers just can't keep track of it all. And they're trying to get our curriculum and teach 50 some kids throughout all of the different classes. So we do rely a lot on the parents. And luckily the co-op board is great, and it's located in Beaverton. So we have a lot of contacts that help us keep the school up and running too.
Cool. Yeah, that pandemic wasn't great timing for anybody, but no. For you guys in particular, was kind of rough. You had just moved, as you said, for the first time in almost 40 years, not being located very visibly within the Karis Elementary, you know, being separate and independent, but having that physical location within Karis School. You were in your own space and didn't have that visibility anymore. And then COVID forced to take a year off, I assume, just because, you know, obviously the restrictions, and probably just couldn't do that with the numbers of kids that you would normally have.
Right. And when we closed in March, I think that everyone thought we would be back in a couple of weeks. And then it was through the end of the school year. And usually our families are siblings. And so we have full classes before the end of the school year. We have full classes for the following year. And that wasn't the case. A lot of families had to homeschool older kiddos, younger siblings weren't familiar with being out in public, and families were just uncertain. So we didn't have enough kiddos to open this school year, and we're happy to be back the school year of 2021-2022. But we also want to get out in the community and share our new location, because we are off Spangler. So there isn't a lot of traffic. The kids that might be going to the elementary school, the word isn't getting out. So they aren't seeing the preschool there anymore. So it was a hard move. It was hard timing.
Right, right. Obviously, yeah, people are kind of excited. It does look like 2022 is going to be a normal year, you know, coming back, and everyone's glad to see that. But yeah, this is kind of that summer, and especially this time period where folks are kind of figuring out, what are we going to do with our younger kids? What preschool options are out there? So it's an important time for you to have that visibility as an option, especially for people in this area. I know you have an event coming up that you can tell us about. You have been doing the farmer's market, right?
We've been out at the Cambies Farmer's Market, and that gave us the idea to have our own farmer's market. So it's the midsummer market. We thought we'd give families some time off from the end of school, and we planned it for July 11th, which is a Sunday. And we'll be out there 9 to 4. So whatever fits with family schedules, and it's at our new location off Spangler Road. So we'll have Kona ice truck, chug coffee, all sorts of vendors for the whole family, but it's also a great opportunity for families to tour the school, meet the teachers, for kiddos to play with other kids and really meet their potential classmates and enroll. But we, at the farmer's market, we just thought it'd be a great idea to get ourselves out in the community and have our own market. And hopefully it's the first annual, so then we can continue keeping it. And we get to support everyone else in our community too. We're hoping that it brings old families to come say hi to the teachers and new families too. So we're looking forward to it.
Very cool. Sounds like a great event. Ashley, do you guys have a website, Facebook, ways that people can check out and find out more about what the Caris Preschool offers? Mm-hmm. Obviously, beyond visiting, this sounds like a very fun event.
Yeah, we have carispreschool.com, so our own website, and that will have the midsummer market date. We're also doing blood drives. We're really trying to get out in the community. So it has all of those fun dates on there. We also have Facebook and an Instagram account that we try to keep updated. And we hope that parents follow that so they can attend these events as well. But on the website, it has all of our email addresses. So if you need to contact us and have any questions, that's great. Great way to keep in touch.
Awesome. Sounds great. Well, Ashley, thanks so much for taking time out to talk to us today. Is there anything else that you'd like to share before you go?
No, thanks so much, Tyler.
All right. Thank you, Ashley. Take care.
You too. Bye.
Tyler, did you know that the Australian lyrebird can mimic any sound that it hears, even chainsaws?
No, that's super interesting.
Did you know that a baby puffin is called a puffling? Or no. That baby sea otters can't swim, so their moms wrap them up in pieces of kelp until they learn how to paddle?
Wait, do you know any trivia that isn't like animal related?
Not really, but here's some stuff you may not know about the Wild Hare Saloon, where Cambie goes to eat and have fun.
Okay.
The Wild Hare is one of Cambie's longest running locally owned restaurants. Owners Joan and Darren Moden have been in business for 16 years.
That's cool.
Yep. Heck, you were just a baby back then. And they love to give back. They've been members of the Cambie Chamber for that long, and they donate over $20,000 to local sports, FFA programs, and civic organizations each year.
Wow, I'm legitimately caught off. That's cool.
Yeah. They also support more than 30 jobs in the community through their award-winning staff, some of them as young as 18. Hey, that's older than you are.
Dude, I'm 10 months younger than you.
With the days getting longer and the weather getting warmer, the Cambie Wild Hare's expansive outdoor patio is the place to be. Furry friends, welcome.
Well, that sounds great. I'm going to go check them out just off of Highway 99E next to the Space Age in Cambie at 1656 Beaver Creek Road in Oregon City, or on their website at thewildhairsaloon.net. Welcome to Now Hear This Cambie,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new, irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?